Hello, Blogging Heads viewers. My name is Dr. Rob Farley of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. With us today is Dr. Toshi Yoshihara, who has, this is actually his second time on the episode, and we're going to talk East Asian maritime politics. How are you doing today, Toshi?
Good. Doing great. Thanks.
Could you introduce yourself for the people who, or at least the ones who didn't see the last episode?
Sure. My name is Toshi Yoshihara, and I'm currently the John A. Van Buren Chair of Asia-Pacific Studies at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island.
How is Newport right now? What's your weather like? Are you getting hit by this big storm? Or?
I'm actually looking out the window right now, and it's sort of gloomy, but it's surprisingly warm for this time of the year. But maybe that's the calm before the storm.
Right. I know it's 64 degrees right now in Lexington, and it's going to be something like 12 by this evening. So, we're about to get hit. Anyway, speaking of getting hit, I think it's fair to say that there was some prize. At least a lot of people were surprised when last week we got a declaration out of China with respect to what's the acronyms now being used, the ADIZ, which is an air defense zone, which overlaps with Japan's and South Korea's and in general has created a whole set of problems. Briefly, can you explain a little bit about what's going on?
Sure. Let me first of all talk a little bit about the ADIZ, the Air Defense Identification Zone, because I think there's been, in fact, a lot of confusion, particularly in the media, about what it is and what it isn't. Mm-hmm. First of all, I think to set the context, it's important to note that in terms of the international community's interpretation and understanding of international law related to this thing, related to airspace, is that there's really two kinds of airspace. There is sort of sovereign airspace, national airspace, in which the state that owns that airspace can take up all kinds of defensive maneuvers, for example, to intercept and to maybe even force an intruding aircraft to land. But then there's the other kind of airspace, which is international airspace. And that's basically international airspace in which aircraft have fundamental basic overflight freedoms. In other words, aircraft flying in international space have the freedom to fly just as ships can sail freely on the high seas. So it's sort of freedom of navigation, but in the air. Mm-hmm. And so given this context, the ADIZ is not, as some have suggested, an extension of China's sovereign airspace into the East China Sea. It's nothing of the sort. The ADIZ is essentially a administrative mechanism. It's basically a regulatory system that a coastal state has the right to extend from their national space over, and this is important, over international airspace. Mm-hmm. So the extension of the zone does not in any way change the nature of the international airspace. In other words, states who have aircraft flying through the ADIZ still enjoy fundamental overflight freedoms. And so what does the ADIZ do? Well, what it does for the coastal state that extends the zone, mm-hmm. it essentially creates mechanisms by which the coastal state can regulate air traffic for primarily national security reasons, but also for safety reasons. And I think what is perhaps the most concerning aspect about China's ADIZ, strictly in terms of how they have declared it, is that they've made a fairly blanket statement that all aircraft must submit flight plans to China in order to pass through the ADIZ. And this blanket statement is important because we really have two very different kinds of aircraft that mm-hmm. typically operate in an ADIZ. The first are civilian commercial aircraft. And the other are foreign military aircraft. And I think it's the latter that becomes very important, because foreign military aircraft really enjoys what you might consider state immunity. You know, foreign military aircraft have every single right to fly through international airspace, and that they cannot be sort of, their flights cannot be disrupted, even if they fly through the ADIZ.
Right, and they don't, they don't have a responsibility to inform before they fly through the space, right? Is that correct?
That's right. Foreign military aircraft have every right to go through the zone without having to inform the coastal state, without having to submit flight plans. In fact, because of the you know, because the fundamental nature of international airspace has not changed because of the zone, even commercial aircraft do not necessarily have to submit flight plans. And they do so really out of courtesy and for safety purposes. And so this is the kind of thing that we're now very closely monitoring, is how the Chinese interpret the zone. Are they going to overreach? And in other words, are they going to make the zone out to be more than what's typically accepted in the international community? And in particular, how they're going to treat foreign military aircraft in a very, very congested, very, very busy airspace over the East China Sea.
Right. I wish I actually had a map. I could have had a map and shown it right here. If you take a look at the map, it's an area which you would clearly anticipate that there would be a lot of military. And, I mean, you know, it's not the middle of the Arctic Ocean or something like that. This is an area where you would anticipate tons of civilian and military air traffic. Now, to my immediate recollection, the United States government has recommended that commercial airlines, or U.S. commercial airlines, actually go through with the notification as sort of this courtesy notification to, I'm not sure which agency they submit this to, whether it's the PLAF or the Chinese government or some other, the Chinese FAA, whatever it may be. But the Japanese have not agreed to this. Is that your understanding?
Yes, my understanding is that the Japanese government position, because it wants to deny Chinese recognition of this unilateral establishment of the zone, the Japanese government has encouraged their major national airlines like Japan Airlines and All Nippon Airlines not to submit flight plans to Chinese aviation authorities. The Americans, on the other hand, have, again, out of, I think, legitimate safety reasons, have encouraged. They're not telling the airlines what to do, but they're saying that if you want to follow federal aviation rules, they are encouraged to submit flight plans to China. And as I understand, at least a dozen countries or more have already begun complying with China's establishment of the zone and of the requirement to submit their flight plans to the authorities.
I mean, is this, do you think, and I want to get to South Korea in a little bit, but do you think that this is this daylight between Tokyo and Washington with respect to this? You know, is this some indication that there, or, you know, maybe can we expect that Japan is pursuing at least a public hard line on this, but maybe is privately encouraging airlines to submit on or at least to give some indication of them traveling through? Or, I mean, I guess to rephrase this question in a short way, how serious is Tokyo about maintaining this distinction, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, sometimes in diplomacy and in alliance politics and coalition management, sometimes form is as important as substance. And I think this disagreement between Japan and the United States is more about form rather than substance. In other words, I think Japan may have been concerned that the Obama administration came out a little too soon, in other words, in recommending the national airlines to submit flight plans. You know, because I think clearly safety should come first. I mean, any kind of accident, miscalculation in the air would have catastrophic consequences. So to the extent that, you know, I think the disagreement might be the extent to which the United States had, behind closed doors or behind back channels, consulted with the Japanese about this decision. And so I think ultimately, you know, I think there's no question, there's no doubt that the United States has Japan's back in terms of the actual substance of this issue, because both Japan and the United States are seeing eye to eye and are on the same page completely with regard to the freedom of foreign military aircraft passing through the zone. I think that's where the real substance is at, which is the allied non-recognition of the zone and regulating their military activities over the East China Sea. And I think that's far more important than the sort of the, I guess you might call it, diplomatic, a slight diplomatic disagreement about the timing of when the U.S. government should have articulated this concern.
Right. Now, what role has Seoul played in this so far? I mean, are the South Koreans essentially making the same noises as the Americans or the Japanese? Or, I mean, I understand the immediate reports was that South Korea was just as irritated by this, because it overlaps their zone as well, was just as irritated about this as the Japanese and the Americans. But what are they saying at this point? Do you know?
Yeah, my understanding is that when the Chinese unilaterally declared the zone, as you mentioned, part of the zone basically overlapped with the South Korean ADIZ, and it also covers an area where there is a territorial dispute between South Korea and China. My understanding is that the South Koreans probed the Chinese by requesting that the Chinese pull back part of that ADIZ so that it didn't overlap, and the Chinese basically said no, turned down the request. And South Korea reacted in the way that the United States and Japan have, which was to send their aircraft into the ADIZ without notifying the Chinese. I've read even more recently is that the South Koreans have, in fact, conducted some drills even in the overlapping zones simply to make the point that the South Koreans don't recognize this Chinese zone. So what's interesting is that the Chinese have managed to really very quickly antagonize,
right,
to be very important players in the region. And just for a little context, I think it's important to note that the ADIZ that was established in East Asia was actually established by the United States. The ADIZs for South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan were actually drawn by the U.S. military for Cold War national security reasons, to create these air buffers to monitor and to trail Soviet air intrusions across maritime Asia. So these zones have been well established, and that in some ways have fed into the Chinese narrative, basically saying, look, if our neighbors so close to us have had these zones for decades, why can't we have one? And that's part of their sort of running arguments defending their zone.
Right. And on the surface, it's not an implausible argument, right? It's not a wholly insensible argument. But, just because it's not a wholly insensible argument does not mean that it hasn't had repercussions. And I want to get back to those repercussions in a second. But first, I think it's worth sort of discussing, the United States immediately violated or crossed into the zone with two B-52 bombers, which was just this fascinating, for me, and I work at a school of diplomacy, and of course you work one that's very similar, right? It's this instance in which we are pointedly making an effort here to not inform China that we're flying two of the most obvious large planes in the world, so that they will obviously know, right? So we're not informing you that we're about to fly these things, which you obviously know are there. And so my understanding is, and you just suggested, South Korea and Japan are basically doing the same thing in terms of these kinds of overflights, right? That we're taking a point of not informing you of this thing you can obviously see. Has there been a Chinese reaction to this that you're aware of so far? Have they done things like trail our B-52s with SU-27s or something like that? Or
Yeah, I think what's important, and I've been reading some of the literature coming out from China that's beginning finally, and I think thankfully beginning to clarify how they're going to enforce the zone. And I think this is critical. It's not just the unilateral establishment of the zone. It's then how will the Chinese follow up in material terms, and how are they going to use their means in order to enforce the zone? There was some speculation, and one of my biggest fears is that the Chinese may stake out this claim and then seek to enforce it to its sort of maximum logical extreme, which is to tail and monitor, scramble aircraft and tail every single foreign military intrusion into the zone. But it turns out that that's probably not going to be the case. I think the Chinese, because of their relatively limited capabilities at present, they're going to be far more selective about how they enforce the zone. So it's possible, for example, that it could range from at the high end scrambling of jet aircraft to tail foreign military aircraft to essentially turning on their sensors, turning on their ground-based radars, possibly turning on their anti-air missile batteries, the radars associated with those units, as a way to simply say, we've turned them on, we know you're in here. We're pretty confident that we've identified you as so and so aircraft, and let that be. Again, time will tell to what extent the Chinese will sort of modulate their behavior and their reactions based on really a whole host of tools that they have at their disposal to track aircraft. So I think In the case of the B-52, and my understanding is in the case of the Japanese intrusions in the zone, the Chinese in the Japanese case, did put in the air jet aircraft, but those fighters were not anywhere near the Japanese intrusions. It was simply to say, we know you're here, we acknowledge it, we're keeping a distance, perhaps out of safety reasons. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure about the Chinese reaction to the B-52s, but my understanding is that the B-52s didn't engage in really provocative behavior, which is to, you know, fly very, very close to Chinese national airspace. So I think the Chinese was afforded enough space to say, we've turned on our radars, we've identified these two aircraft, we know who you are, and simply left it at that. And hopefully, if that sort of more selective form of ADIZ enforcement continues, then I think some of our initial fears that there might be a real danger of escalation, aircraft falling out of the sky, I think those might be a bit less possible now. And hopefully the Chinese will continue to behave in ways that maintain stability over the East China Sea.
Right. And I mean, we should also note that it's certainly possible for, you know, if the United States or Japan in particular wanted to be more provocative, we could do something like sail the George Washington in there and have full deck exercises for a while and just see what would happen, right? But it's not necessary for us to undertake that kind of provocation if we don't want to.
That's right. And I think our goal, really, I mean, I think our goal, if we want to maintain stability, is to, you know, conduct in a stable, professional manner, which is to say we're going to take some actions to simply to make the point that we don't recognize your zone, but we're not going to engage in provocative behavior that's going to force you to engage in provocative counter behavior. So, for example, one can very easily imagine Japanese or U.S. fighters flying towards Chinese national airspace and then, you know, missing Chinese national airspace by a few miles or a few kilometers. That would force the Chinese to launch aircraft and then engage in close tailing. I think that's the kind of situation where you would have miscalculation. And I don't think that it's in the interest of the United States or Japan to do that. And certainly I would think that the Chinese don't want us to do that. But this is the important and this is the interesting part, is that in some ways this does give us some level of leverage and initiative. In other words, we can do all kinds of spooky, funny things to force the Chinese to react. We haven't done that yet, but that means that card is still to be played. And so, you know, yes, you know, the Chinese may have knocked us back a little bit with the surprise move, but, you know, there are, you know, a whole series of subsequent moves that we can make that could make life a bit more difficult for the Chinese. Because in my view, the zone essentially puts the onus on the Chinese to enforce the zone, right? If they want to demonstrate integrity of the zone, they're the ones who are going to have to put up the aircraft, which is very expensive, time consuming, and also resource intensive. And so, you know, maybe, you know, over the longer term, this plays to our ability to perhaps play some cost imposing games on the on the Chinese down the road. But again, the state of our relationship with China is such that I don't think we're going to be able to do that. Now, you know, we have plenty of precedent during the Cold War that we played all kinds of games with the Soviets and vice versa. We're not there yet. But again, you know, hopefully what we'll be able to do is to engage in a very business-like, professional manner where, you know, we're not going to play games that will lead to like the EP3 incident in April of 2001.
Right. So, with respect to the strategic logic behind this and the timing, you know, it seemed to a lot of observers, and I think, you know, a few people pointed this out, like Robert Kelly and others have pointed this out, that in the weeks leading up to this, relations between South Korea and Japan were reaching a low. You know, again, for lots of reasons that are sort of often hard to understand when you're not part of that relationship between those two countries. But you had, you know, a scaling up of rhetoric between the two that just really seemed unnecessary. But that really, and I, you know, I observed, and I think other people observed, like, wow, you know, if Beijing had wanted to make Japan and South Korea friends again, this is the best way to do it, right? What do you think maybe was the strategic motivation between Beijing doing this right now? And was there any sense that they may have anticipated this reaction that they got from the Northeast Asian allies?
Yes. You know, I think there are actually a variety of reasons, and you're right. It's there are some deeper strategic rationales for doing this, and then there are sort of more immediate causes to why the Chinese did this. You know, it's the, you know, I ask myself too, you know, why here, why now, you know, at a time where, tensions are running high. And so I think, you know, certainly I think, it's important first to state why we were so concerned, because I think Japan and the United States certainly recognizes that China, in technical terms, in principle, had every right to declare the zone unilaterally. That's given to all states. You know, states have the right to establish these zones, again, as long as they do not violate the fundamental principles of overflight freedoms. But again, the timing suggests that this was not helpful. I mean, you know, if you want to measure the wisdom, the prudence of this move in terms of whether it's helpful to regional stability, I think there's consensus that this was not helpful. So why? You know, why were the Chinese doing this? I think, first of all, the dispute over the Senkakus is, I would say, one of the more immediate causes of this. By establishing the ADIZ, that not so coincidentally extends over into the Senkakus, what this does is it puts the Senkakus dispute right back on the table. One of the things that have irked the Chinese for a very long time is that the Japanese government has refused to even acknowledge that a dispute exists over the Senkakus. And so by establishing the ADIZ, the Chinese are simply saying, we disagree that this is, in fact, in on-the-ground reality. You can say all you want diplomatically that no dispute exists, but we are now demonstrating to the world that a dispute certainly does exist. And what's interesting about the Senkakus is the Chinese believe that the Senkakus Diaoyu Island, of course, is theirs. So therefore, the airspace above the islands are actually Chinese national airspace.
Right.
And so by establishing that ADIZ, it simply reinforces the claim that that's essentially what it is, that not only are the Diaoyus Chinese territory, but that the airspace above the islands are Chinese national airspace. And this is reinforced, I think, by an incident that occurred a few months ago when we believe a UAV, an unmanned aerial vehicle of Chinese origin, went over the islands. That was tracked down by the Japanese, and there were some, you know, a lot of talk that was made available to the public that the Abe administration was considering creating mechanisms by which he could order a shoot down of foreign UAVs over the island, which was essentially saying this still is Japanese national airspace. And so, again, the creation of the ADIZ is a pushback against that narrative, because I think the more that the Chinese don't push back, the more that the Chinese are, in fact, conceding the Japanese side that no dispute exists on the island. So, again, this is part of that diplomatic tussle, the sort of the, you know, he said, she said kind of a game that's going on over the islands. But I think there's more to it than that. I think the larger strategic rationale for the Chinese is really an attempt to gain greater strategic control over the bodies of water bounded by the first island chain. And that's the Yellow Sea, East China Sea, Taiwan Strait, and the South China Sea. And by doing the ADIZ, what they've created is a new normal above the waters of the East China Sea. The new normal is, of course, when various foreign governments are urging their airlines to submit flight plans to Chinese authorities. What it does is it at least symbolically, implicitly confers to China what it considers to be its prerogatives over those bodies of water and the airspace above those waters. And so this is, again, a sort of a larger move for China to be able to assert greater control over these areas. And I think that's really, you know, what this game is about. And I think ultimately, if you have a very sort of more pessimistic interpretation of what China wants, is the end state, you know, sort of the ultimate outcome that the Chinese want is essentially for the neighboring states around China to defer to China in terms of critical strategic events happening in those bodies of water. And so, again, by forcing states to submit flight plans to China, this is one small step, but I think a step, nevertheless, in that direction. And I think this is consistent, for example, and this is very much related to Chinese claims over the exclusive economic zone.
Right.
Because the Chinese have made clear that the ADIZ essentially neatly overlaps with China's exclusive economic zones in the East China Sea. Now, let me just sort of make clear what the international community's interpretation of the EEZ is and how that contrasts with China and how that sort of plays into China's games. The EEZ, essentially, based on our understanding of the UN Law of the Sea, is that it confers jurisdictional rights to coastal states that claim those zones to exclusively to resources above and beneath the seabed within those zones. What the Chinese have said all along, and I agree with them, that they haven't changed their minds. They haven't suddenly added on, tacked on new interpretations. They have all along argued, no, that the EEZs actually confer additional jurisdictional rights, including the right of coastal states to restrict certain activities, including military research activities. Inside the EEZ. Essentially, they're saying in addition to economic rights, it also confers some level of sovereign rights to the coastal state. This is very much at odds with the way we look at the law of the sea in general and in terms of freedom
and
of navigation.
And this is it's situations like this that have led to the incident we had a couple years back with the intelligence gathering vessel, the name of which escapes me, but that was not within Chinese territorial waters, but was within the EEZ, to my recollection.
That's right. That's right. It was the USNS Impeccable in April of 2009, where they had fishing trawlers run very perilously close to the vessel and claiming again that the Americans had no permission from the Chinese. So, again, the fact that they're basically reinforcing those claims by imposing the ADIZ is simply, in my view, the larger goal is to restrict our freedom of maneuver, especially within the waters of the first island chain. And so, again, that is why we've been so insistent that we will not recognize the zone in terms of their ability to regulate foreign military aircraft. Because if we do, if we ever acknowledged it, then we might as well pack up and go home. Because that means that would confer China's right to essentially dictate and regulate our access and our freedom of military maneuver across the entire near sea.
Right. I mean, and it's interesting too because, you know, there may be an and I want to sort of ask. I want to ask one more question, sort of about, you know, where exactly this is stemming from in the Chinese foreign policy bureaucracy. But before then, it seems to me that part of the point here is not or any sort of expectation that the United States is immediately going to change its behavior, right? But it's this expectation that there's going to be another decision somewhere in the United States naval and foreign policy bureaucracy where people are going to have to say, well, you know, do we really want to, you know, cause another international incident here by sending an aircraft through? And so she's like, well, maybe not this time, right? And once that becomes a point in the decision chain, you've essentially accomplished your goal, right? That you know, different administrations are going to view that decision differently and it's going to become political in a variety of ways. And so that, you know, sort of changing the way that decisions are made in the United States, you know, rather than actually establishing an exclusion is part of the point here.
Right. And so, like, and to add on to that, you know, ancient Chinese strategist, you know, Sun Tzu said, you know, one of the preferred strategies is to attack your enemy's alliances. And I think this does that very well in a very subtle sort of salami slicing tactic way. And that is by even demonstrating daylight between Japan and the United States about the ADIZ, as the Chinese successfully did because of the differences over whether commercial airlines should submit flight plans, is that by accentuating the differences between Japan and the United States, that's in the win column for China. And in particular, I think by establishing the ADIZ, I think the Chinese recognize that the Japanese attach far greater value over what happens in the East China Sea compared to the United States. And therefore, you would expect different reactions. Right. And not surprisingly, Japan was more hardline than the United States. And by accentuating the allied differences over the value that they attach to the real estate, not only over the Senkakus, but over the East China Sea, the Chinese are employing a very clever wedge strategy with the alliance. And by that, again, a gradual corrosion of Japanese allied confidence in the United States, maybe not today, but maybe a few years from now, that lack of confidence or an erosion of confidence will play itself out down the road.
Now, the way you've described this, especially in this last section here, it does sort of really seem like and I know that there's been some conversation about this where sort of an argument that this was sort of an almost accidental product of the Chinese foreign policy bureaucracy. Like, you know, one hand maybe not talking to the other about, you know, exactly how to declare this and publicize this and so forth. You know, from what you've been suggesting, though, it seems a little, it does seem a little bit more strategic. Or, you know, is Beijing just trying to, you know, sort of make a strategic move out of what was basically a bureaucratic mess from the beginning? What's your sense about this? Is this coming from the top, or is this just something that sort of happened and the top is trying to make sense of it?
Yeah, you know, my understanding from the media reports is that Xi was very close. Xi Jinping, President Xi Jinping, was very close to the decision in establishing the zone, and that debates and deliberations over the zone have been going on for at least 6 months, if not more.
Okay.
And so it seems to me that there is some high-level sanction and support for the establishment of the zone. And I just want to comment a little bit about the general sort of reaction to Chinese provocations. You know, I think there is a school of thought in the United States and in other PLA watching communities that the Chinese are just bumbling fools. You know, they just can't get their act together. Their bureaucracies are a mess. The left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. The foreign ministry, you know, is always kept in the dark about what the PLA is doing. Speculation about the PLA becoming a rogue organization, and so on and so forth. And it's really about Chinese bureaucratic organizational ineptitude than sort of any malign sort of strategic intent on the part of the Chinese. I think that goes too far. And if, frankly, I think those arguments essentially give the Chinese a bye when they take on these provocative actions. I would argue, again, if you trace the pattern of Chinese behavior, statements, and actions over the last 4 or 5 years, it's a consistent pattern of creating realities on the ground, putting a marker out, and then gradually enforcing it, and then presenting essentially a fait accompli to the international community. I mean, it's been, you can go back even further to as far back as the 1970s in terms of Chinese actions in the South China Sea, or the 1990s in the South China Sea. So this seems to me the pattern is too consistent, and the pattern has in fact identified the timing, the time lag between one action versus the other has actually shortened. And so it seems to me that there is more coordination and there's more consensus, I think, about what the Chinese are doing than we give them credit for. And so I think there's a danger if we keep falling back to Chinese ineptitude that we're simply going to write these off as basically, you know, bureaucratic mistakes.
Right.
And then we would then, I think, risk basically, you know, being in a passive defensive manner. So, so the question is, you know, if we take that line of argument, at what point will we draw a red line and say, okay, that's, you know, enough's enough? And at what point would it be too late? Essentially, if we keep giving the Chinese these excuses, will at some point, you know, the Chinese reach a point in which we are not able to, you know, kind of push back hard enough? And so I think, you know, we need to be careful not to sort of attribute this too much to Chinese ineptitude, and at least be open-minded to the fact that this, you know, there might be some strategic intent behind all of these actions. Again, it's just the pattern is too consistent to simply write it off as mistakes.
Right. I mean, in some sense, this is an argument between sort of Allison's first model and Allison's second model, and how we should interpret for those political scientists among us. Right. The most famous article in the history of political science is this. About the conceptual models in the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? And there's this long-running debate in political science about, you know, how rational do we treat state behavior versus organizational behavior? And you seem to, you know, I think what you want to suggest is that we've sort of gone too far towards the organizational model in terms of interpreting Chinese behavior, and we need to move a little bit back towards the rational actor model, which, you know, does say that states actually do have intent and goals and so forth. I guess along these lines, there were some people who... There were reports, at least, that the Liaoning, the new Chinese aircraft carrier, was being sent for trials to the South China Sea. And I'm not actually sure how that played out. I mean, whether did the carrier actually deploy down there just for tests and trials, about sort of how intentional that was to do that at the same time that this was happening with respect to the East China Sea. Do you have any sense there whether there was sort of concerted action to send a message with the aircraft, which the aircraft carrier basically can't do anything yet except sail around and do trials. But was there intent there as well to sort of link this East China and South China Sea issues?
Yeah, it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell whether this was a coordinated effort on the part of the Chinese to send a message. The Chinese side claims that, you know, this is simply a routine attempt, essentially, at beginning to test the carrier more, rigorously. And I think it makes sense for them to deploy to the South China Sea. It's a larger operating area, the varying water depths in that particular region, some places are more shallower and some places are deeper than others. Mm-hmm. But that kind of a more complex operating environment it certainly would make sense for the Chinese to test their carriers there. So, there are
And the temperature is different too, right? I mean, right now it's actually quite cold. And so going down there tests a different systems for the carrier as well.
That's right. That's right. And so I think, I think in that sense, the Chinese would have done this anyway. Based on the reports, what they are now calling is a limited carrier battle group. Essentially, mm-hmm. It was the carrier itself, two DDGs and two FFGs that escorted the carrier from Qingdao headquarters of the Chinese Navy.
For amateurs, yeah. Those are DDG is technically it's guided missile destroyer, but it really just means destroyer, and FFG is frigate. So
that's right, and so it was basically a battle group or a flotilla that sailed from Qingdao through the East China Sea, through the Taiwan Strait to reach Sanya Naval Base on the southern tip of Hainan Island. That's a major naval base with fairly impressive basing infrastructure to support a whole range of naval forces, including their nuclear-powered attack submarines. Mm-hmm. And now we know a full-up facilities to park their carriers there. And so this also, I think, sends a pretty powerful signal to Southeast Asian nations because, mm-hmm. as you know, China's carriers may be no match even against Japan and certainly no match against the United States. But that carrier could potentially be, and subsequent versions of it that the Chinese mm-hmm. might build, would be a fearsome asset against the much weaker Southeast Asian nations. So this is in some ways an indirect show of force. I'm sure all the capitals in Southeast Asia have mm-hmm. taken notice of this move.
Right, and I think I also saw a report that the J-15, which is the Chinese version of the Chinese carrier-based version of the Sukhoi 27, is just going into mass production now, which will presumably be the aircraft that flies off the aircraft that flies off the Liaoning. I think this has been a fantastic conversation. Is there anything else you wanted to add? It's been very, very interesting. So,
no, this is thank you for having me on your show. This has been a great talk.
Well, great. Thank you. Thank for Entanglement viewers. Thank you, and hopefully we'll talk again soon because I'm sure that something else is going to happen soon with respect to this. Right? There's always something going on. With respect to this. Sort of what you discuss in terms of this extension and then sort of gradual moving forward of what China perceives as its responsibilities in this area or its rights and responsibilities in this area. So
that's
all right. Well, thank you very much.